it's an important topic to go over just because the three-chamber system I refer to as the black box, even though it's a white box, but it feels like a black box because people come into it, take a look at it. They're not really sure what they're supposed to be looking at, but they look at it anyway and they walk out of the room. And so I think it's important to kind of decipher the black box a little bit.
That's Dr. Mihir Parikh, an interventional pulmonologist at BIDMC. Welcome to the CoreAM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Shrey Trivedi.
And I'm Alexander Castro, a third-year internal medicine resident at BIDMC.
Today, we're talking all things about pneumothorax. All right, let's get into it. Test yourself by pausing after these questions. And remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, diagnosis of pneumothorax.
Which imaging modality is the best for diagnosis and what types of pneumothorax are important to recognize?
Pearl 2, initial pneumothorax management.
Who gets a chest tube and who can be conservatively managed?
Pearl 3, understanding the pleural drainage system.
Do you have a step-by-step approach of looking through a pleural drainage system?
Pearl 4, air leak monitoring.
What is an air leak and how do you know how bad it is?
Pearl 5, persistent air leaks.
When we diagnose an air leak as persistent, what are the options that we can use to treat it? A quick word from our sponsor, Oakstone CME's ACP MixApp Audio Companion. What would it feel like to have bite-sized MixApp teaching ready to go anywhere with you and earn CME credit at the same time? Take a listen.
I found it very interesting, the line that points out that observational studies suggest an increase in heart failure with insulin therapy. That's something I hadn't known prior to this exercise.
Yes, and a lot of patients now are interested in considering a GLP-1 receptor agonist. These drugs reduce major adverse cardiovascular events, but have no effect or detriment in patients with heart failure.
So for 50 years, Oakstone CME has really helped busy clinicians stay current with expert-led education, free of commercial influence. From board prep to earning CME, they have a mobile-friendly platform that offers trusted multimedia content designed for learning on the go. You can earn over 115 AMA PRA Category 1 credits and 115 ABM MOC points annually, and even more if you have a three-year access plan. You can multitask while you absorb the latest medical knowledge with MixApp ACP Audio Companion, a podcast-style tool packed with expert insights, board prep, and more CME credits than ever. You can stream or download anytime. And exclusive to CoreAM listeners, you can use the code CORE25 for 25% off. Go to oakstone.com/MixApp. That's oakstone/MKSAP. Use the code CORE25. And with that, let's get into the episode. So before we get into all good things about imaging pearls and the diagnosis of a pneumothorax, let's start with just what is a pneumothorax?
Yeah. And so what I do tell patients is that what I explain to them is that, you know, there's been some injury to the lining of the lung and that has led air to escape from the lung into the space between the lung and the chest wall.
So Dr. Parikh describes pneumothorax as air that escapes from the lung and accumulates between the lung and the chest wall, or more formally for us, the visceral and parietal pleura, outside the lung but within the pleural cavity. And these are split into two main categories, primary and secondary.
So the spontaneous pneumothorax is sort of that, you know, the run-of-the-mill patient walking down the street all of a sudden develops chest pain and develops a pneumothorax. And that is subdivided into two groups. So this primary spontaneous pneumothorax and secondary spontaneous pneumothorax. So primary spontaneous pneumothorax means that they don't have any underlying lung disease, whereas secondary spontaneous pneumothorax, it means that they have some underlying lung disease that we think predispose them to developing spontaneous pneumothorax. Most commonly, that's severe COPD emphysema, but other things can be like cystic lung disease.
So primary spontaneous pneumothorax, that's going to occur without underlying lung disease. And then secondary spontaneous pneumothorax, that's going to be usually in the setting of some underlying lung disease. And hold on to that idea, because understanding the underlying lung parenchyma is going to be important in thinking about what's the best imaging modality for diagnosing pneumothorax.
I think that by far the most common way I've seen pneumothorax diagnosed is via chest x-rays, but I was surprised to learn how much positioning matters in cinching the diagnosis.
And the point I like to make with plain films is that, you know, the sensitivity of a plain film, like a chest x-ray, goes a lot when you put them into the correct position. So, you know, air rises with gravity, right? And so a supine chest x-ray, when the patient's lying flat, actually pretty poor sensitivity for pneumothorax. You need to have over 150 or 200 milliliters of air in the chest before you can start seeing that on a supine film. So really getting a patient into an upright position. You know, and most of these are portable films, so not always easy to get the proper PA and lateral, but certainly putting that stretcher into as upright or semi-recumbent position as possible is really going to increase the sensitivity of plain film for pneumothorax.
And now that he talks about positioning the stretcher upright or semi-recumbent, I feel like, duh, like, why haven't I coached my patient to do that or write it in the comments so that, you know, when I'm ordering that portable chest x-ray, the tech can kind of help operationalize that?
Yeah, totally agree. It's such a small change that apparently can make such a major difference. So now let's move on to my favorite ultrasound, which in this case, we typically use with a linear probe placed between the rib spaces.
And what you want to see is that there is that shimmering or that lung sliding or that ant marging, which correlates with the two pleural surfaces, the visceral and parietal pleural surfaces rubbing up against each other. When you lose that, when there's a pneumothorax, right, the pleural surface has fallen off the chest wall. So you don't see the visceral and parietal pleural surfaces in contact with each other. You'll lose that lung sliding. And that's called the absence of lung sliding or the loss of lung sliding. And that can be suggestive of a pneumothorax.
So just to hammer home the learning point, the lung sliding that we see is the movement of the pleura against the chest wall.
And so if you lose that lung sliding or shimmering on ultrasound, that means that the pleural surface is no longer fully expanded.
But of course, not all things in medicine can be so simple. And so not every loss of lung sliding means a puncture of the lining of the lung.
I say suggestive of a pneumothorax because it's important to say that there are certain situations in which you can lose lung slide and not have a pneumothorax, right? And so that can happen in situations where the patient's undergone a prior pleuridesis, right? So if that patient's going to undergone pleuridesis, that visceral pleural surface is stuck up to the chest wall. So you're not going to see that sliding. If there's poor respiratory motion as well, too, you may just not see the patient sort of ventilating enough to move the lung in that shimmering motion. Certain patients with really bad bullous emphysema also can lose lung sliding, even though the pleural surfaces are in contact with each other.
So it's important to sort out any prior pleural procedures or surgeries or any sort of underlying lung disease before anchoring in on pneumothorax as the only cause of a lack of lung sliding.
So those are nuances on ultrasound. We also sat down with Dr. Darlene Nelson, an interventional pulmonologist at Mayo Clinic, about when we might reach for a CAT scan after seeing a pneumo on a chest x-ray.
So if someone has underlying known emphysematous lung disease with a lot of bulla, sometimes on an x-ray, it can look like a pneumothorax, but it's actually a large bulla. And I've had several patients present with this. And if there is a question, I would encourage a CT scan to make sure that it actually is a pneumo versus a contained bulla. Because I've seen patients come in and have chest tubes placed into bulla inadvertently, as opposed to just actually having a pneumothorax.
Yikes. X-rays can fool you because a bulla can look like a pneumothorax, and ultrasound can also fool you because bulla can result in loss of lung sliding.
Exactly. And that CAT scan is going to be great in giving us also the exact size of the pneumothorax and for visualizing any loculations in a complex loculated pneumothorax, which could be difficult to see on an X-ray or an ultrasound.
All right. So to summarize, each major imaging modality for pneumothorax has pros and cons. Chest x-rays are fast and easy to obtain, but optimizing position with an upright image will greatly increase your yield and chances of catching a small pneumothorax. Ultrasound is an excellent and sensitive modality, but is operator dependent, and don't be fooled by lack of lung sliding. Always be sure to check the one-liner for severe underlying lung disease, any prior surgeries, or prior pleuridesis.
And then CT can be a helpful tiebreaker that gives you the full picture as to the size of the pneumothorax, the location, and then any underlying lung pathology that might be mimic a pneumothorax, like emphysematous disease. So after we've diagnosed a pneumothorax, let's get into who should we intervene on and who we should not.
You know, whenever I think about a pneumothorax, I just have this reflex to place a chest tube. I feel that pressure to place the interventional pulmonology consult and try to get that tube in as soon as possible.
This is all like good points to bring up, right? Like, do all pneumothoraxes get a chest tube? And then does it matter like how big is it, or is there something else that matters?
my little maxim, which doesn't always work, is first symptoms over size. And let me explain that a little further. So if I have a patient with underlying parenchymal lung disease, such as interstitial lung disease or emphysema or COPD, they can have a small pneumothorax, small to moderate, but be very symptomatic, having increasing oxygen requirements, increasing tachypnea. And in those situations, I am going to intervene.
Yes, intervene indeed. So I guess what Dr. Nelson is saying is that it's more about the clinical presentation than how big that pneumothorax is.
Exactly. Signs and symptoms that would make you err towards intervening rather than watchful waiting. The most worrisome situation here is tension pneumothorax, where air continues to get into the pleural space but can't escape, and then starts to compress structures in the thorax, making it harder to breathe and harder for the heart to pump blood to the rest of the body.
And so those are probably the most important clues you're going to look for, is sort of that combination of tachycardia, hypotension, and jugovenous ascension, right? The three sort of cardinal signs of tension physiology are something to certainly look out for. And with that, evidence of respiratory failure, but something to keep an eye out for, especially in the medicine world, is evidence of subcutaneous emphysema, especially around the neck and the upper torso, and voice changes or difficulty swallowing.
Okay, so when we get called to the bedside for someone with a pneumothorax, we're going to look at the vitals to see if there's any tachycardia, low blood pressure, look at the patient, right, see if there's any jugular venous distension, and worst of all, look for any subcutaneous emphysema, which is most often under the skin in that neck chest area.
And so in cases of tension pneumothorax, emergent needle decompression or emergent chest tube placement is going to be the next step.
Yeah, I hope I never have to be a part of any emergent cheek compression or chest tube placement. I haven't, and I hope I never will. But now that we talked about the scary stuff, let's talk about when it isn't tension physiology and how do we approach a patient who is a bit more stable.
There's actually a large study that came in from Australia and New Zealand. It was a randomized controlled trial of patients with moderate to large, so not even small, moderate to large spontaneous pneumothorax. And so what they did is they randomized these patients to two arms. And the first was like routine management, which, as I said, was the old algorithms where you went on size or symptoms and put in the two, versus the conservative arm, which was to walk the patients around the emergency room. If they're able to do so without difficulty and without desaturating, and a repeat chest x-ray done after 4 hours showed no interval worsening of pneumothorax, they were discharged home with no intervention. And they found their primary outcome measures were, you know, of course, need for additional interventions or return to the emergency room, and found no difference between these two groups.
Wow. So a moderate to large spontaneous pneumothorax can just be watched? Man, I am so glad there's some solid data to also back up that symptoms over size mantra.
And you'll see that reflected now with the newest British guidelines for pneumothorax. For spontaneous pneumothorax, don't actually have a size criteria in their algorithm. It's more based on symptoms. And so that's why now I'm starting to move more towards that, where even patients with a moderate pneumothorax, see how they're feeling. They're having chest pain, discomfort, feeling short of breath, certainly intervene. But if not, watch them for 4 hours. If the pneumothorax isn't growing and they're not developing symptoms, then I think it's reasonable to keep an eye on them, but not put in a tube.
Definitely. I was surprised that so many patients can just be watched, but I'm definitely glad we don't have to subject every patient with a pneumothorax to a chest tube.
Yeah, thankful that not putting chest tubes in is a part of the management and we can just closely monitor an asymptomatic pneumothorax. But let's say our patient is stable, so none of the scary vital sign abnormalities, but symptomatic, right? And say all signs are pointing towards a chest tube in the near future. I think the most important thing is, like, how do we explain to our patients when we're rounding, you know, in the morning, in the ED, how do we counsel patients about the next steps and what they can expect?
I really liked how Dr. Van Holden, an interventional pulmonologist at the University of Maryland, explains this to her patients.
So when I explain pneumothoraces to patients, I like to inform patients there is some sort of injury in the lung that is creating a hole. So when you're breathing in the air, it's leaking out of this hole into the space between the lung and the rib cage, and it's building up air. The chest tube would be a small tube that would be placed between the ribs in order to help drain that air so that the lung can expand again. So we kind of think of the lung as a balloon, and when the air is escaping the balloon, it's kind of deflating, and you're trying to release that air between the ribs and the lung so that the lung can expand again.
Nice. That is such good imagery, thinking about the lung as a deflated balloon in the chest wall, and air is leaking out of that balloon. And that chest tube is going to be put in there to help drain out that air that's trapped between the chest wall and the balloon. And then the balloon, or the lung in this case, will expand again.
And then last but not least, the other arm of management is pain control. Chest tubes are definitely uncomfortable, but I appreciated hearing Dr. Parikh's take on his anecdotal experience on who may or may not experience more pain with chest tube placement.
I have found that I think patients with normal lungs, like normal lungs, tend to have more pain. I think the reason for that is patients with sort of secondary spontaneous pneumothorax, if they have underlying disease lungs, they probably had some interventions in their chest or have had some underlying lung pathology. So the pleural surface, I think, does become sort of like chronically abnormal over time. Whereas patients who have normal lungs, therefore have normal pleural surfaces, tend to have more discomfort because I think their pleural surfaces just tend to get irritated more often. And these primary spontaneous pneumothoraces tend to be in these lanky young men. And I don't know if it's just their own biases about their pain tolerance, but they do tend to need more pain control than other patients at Mount.
Yeah, I'm so glad we're bringing this up. And it's definitely refreshing to check our biases when we might think, oh, this is a young person. They should be able to handle it better. Why are they asking for so many pain meds? And maybe think more about the physiology and what a normal pleural surface might be more sensitive to than pleural surfaces who have seen more disease over time.
So to summarize pneumothorax management, symptoms over size is the name of the game. For patients with little to no symptoms, regardless of size, and even in large pneumothorax, conservative management can be a reasonable strategy. But for patients with signs or symptoms like dyspnea, tachypnea, and tachycardia, placing a chest tube makes sense. And don't forget to keep a close eye out for signs of hypotension, tachypnea, jugular venous distension, subcutaneous emphysema, all of which suggest tension physiology and warrant immediate intervention.
All right. Man, let's get into all things about the different columns of the chest tube, aka the pleural drainage system. And this whole section was just a wonderful eureka moment to me, to the point where I look back and I'm like, did I ever know any of this before? I thought I did. I used to use these words, and I think just speaks to, you know, how great some of the discussants were.
Totally agree. Water seals, pressures, gradients, suction adjustments, where to start when bending down and looking at the chest tube chamber, and then where to go based on what you see.
Yeah, I love the way Dr. Parikh broke down each chamber, or maybe another way to think about it is that there's three different parts of the drainage system. And now the drainage system is kind of inverted. We're going to look at it going from right to left. And so the first chamber, which is where air from the patient's lung goes into, is on the right side, and then we're going to move left. So that first chamber is called the collection chamber, and there's three different columns on the right side.
First chamber is the collection chamber. So that's the chamber that comes off the patient first. And it's literally just a collection chamber. It's a glorified graduated cylinder, I say. It's really a way for us to measure pleural fluid output per unit time. Less relevant in a discussion of pneumothorax, but certainly important in other patients with a hemothorax or a pleural effusion for some other reason, where you really want to get a sense of how much fluid per hour, per day, or so on.
So that first column chamber is those three columns, and they can hold up to 2,000 cc's. And this is where we're going to see markings from nurses with dates and hours and timings to track how much fluid might be collected out of the drainage system. Now, typically, we could ignore this collection chamber in a pneumothorax, but just to say it out loud, our body does produce 10 to 50 cc's of pleural fluid a day. So don't be alarmed if you see a little bit of pleural fluid there.
Exactly. And for pneumothorax, what you really want to look at is the second chamber, which is also known as the water seal chamber. In most drainage systems, this is usually in the corner, usually a vibrant blue color because it's literally filled with water. And this has two major purposes. The first is protective and the second is diagnostic. So let's start by understanding how this chamber helps protect our patients.
The second chamber is the water seal. And so this is an important one because this is the way that we protect patients when they have a chest tube in place. Remember that intrapleural pressure is negative to the ambient environment. And so if you just had a tube coming out from the patient's chest into pleural space, there would be a gradient for air to move into the chest, right? Because pleural pressure is negative. And that would cause you to have a pneumothorax again and sort of defeat the purpose of putting in a chest tube to begin with. And so that's where the water seal comes in. So the water seal is just a thin column of water that is pretty easy for air or fluid or air to displace away from the patient. And so that's the beauty of the water seal. It really only allows air to move in one direction away from the patient.
So the water seal is a one-way valve that allows air to exit the pleural cavity during exhalation, but doesn't allow it to re-enter during inhalation.
And so because this chamber is such an important protective mechanism, one thing to make sure of is that there's actually water in the chamber itself. Make sure it hasn't spilled or evaporated, or that someone didn't forget to put water in there at all.
But yeah, I think the real money when it comes to water seals is the diagnostic portion of it. And when it comes to the water seal chamber, it's particularly diagnostic for something what we call air leak. And it's something that's a term we throw around all the time, but just crystal clear, what is an air leak?
So an air leak is literally bubbling within the water seal chamber itself. And if you see bubbling, that represents that there's still a pneumothorax present. More precisely, an air leak means that air is still flowing from the pleural cavity and then into the chamber.
Yes, so it sounds like there's still more air being trapped in that pleura when we see that bubbling.
The water seal is where we're going to look for the air leak. So that's really something to keep an eye on when you're examining patients with pneumothorax every day, because that's going to really help you if the air leak persists. But that's where you're looking to see if there's ongoing air moving out of the chest or moving out of the pleural space, which is consistent with an air leak, meaning the hole in the lung hasn't healed yet. So it's always good to just do a quick look to make sure that, is there water in the water seal and are you seeing bubbling to suggest an air leak?
And because this water seal chamber is so important in the management of pneumothorax, we're going to dedicate a whole pearl, our next pearl, into what we're actually looking at when we look at the water seal chamber to see how bad that air leak is, or is it just normal titling? But before we get into there, let's round out our discussion on the three different parts of the drainage system with a third and last part, which is the suction control chamber.
So suction is extra negative pressure that's used to help air flow out of the pleural space. One key point to understand about how the chest tube works is that air moves from areas of high to low pressure. Hence, why interventional pulmonology is asking you to set the suction to digits in the negative to create that gradient for air to move through.
Man, I had such a big aha, because I think I never really understood why they were paging me, you know, or my team to change it to negative 30 suction or negative 20. But then when I relearned, oh, this is so humbling, like when you relearn the basics and like why you had to relearn it in the first place. When I relearned the basics that the interpleural pressure of is usually negative 4 or negative 5, your point that air moves from high pressure to low pressure made so much sense. Because of course, we need to set the suction to something lower than negative 5 or negative 4. And so that's going to be more effective to move that air from the intrapleural space to the drainage system.
Most times when you're connecting the chest tube to suction, the chest tube or the pleural back is set at minus 20 centimeters of water. That's just an arbitrary setting that we've set it at. Whereas when it's actually connected to the wall suction is generally set at negative 100 or sometimes negative 200, or sometimes it's just cranked to max, depending on whoever's in the room setting it up. And so let's give a hypothetical example in which that suction control chamber didn't exist and we just connected chamber number 2 directly up to the wall suction and therefore exerted negative 100 to negative 200 centimeters of water pressure on the chest. And remember that normal pleural pressure is probably about negative 4 or negative 5. So if you were to put someone with a chest tube to negative 100 or negative 200, that's going to be extremely painful and probably pretty dangerous as well, too, and rip open the lung. And so that's where that suction control chamber really comes into handy, because what that is a sort of intermediate step between the water seal and the wall suction.
So to break that down, we really need that suction control to be that middleman between the water seal chamber and the wall suction, which can be set to crazy high pressures like negative 200, which would be pretty dangerous for our patients.
And so if you're curious as to how the suction control chamber protects our patients from those really negative pressures, the suction control chamber actually has a pop-off valve that's open to the ambient environment. And once the system has hit a certain level of suction or of negative pressure, this valve opening and closing regulates the pressures.
Great. I'm glad we're talking about this because I think practically speaking, now when I go look at the chest tube of the pleural drainage system, I'm going to look for that circle knob. Again, there's different types of pleural drainage systems. If it's a dry suction chamber, usually on the top left, there's a circle knob and I can just exactly see now what the suction is set to. And I think the other thing that interventional palm often pages us about is to move that suction to this number and then move it down and then move it up. And then sometimes it just feels like a cycle. And I think I never really appreciated the nuances as to why.
When chest tubes are placed for pneumothoraces, it's really this balance between having the lung expanded with suction. However, that airflow with suction is going to perpetuate that airflow gradient across the alveolar pleural fistula, which may impair its ability to heal. So the amount of suction is you want to remove enough air for the lung to expand, but not so much that it's not going to allow the fistula to heal. So removing patients off of suction as quickly as possible is the goal.
So suction is really a double-edged sword. It can help remove air from the pneumothorax more quickly and cause the lung to re-expand, but it can also drive more air from the actual lung into the pneumothorax itself. And if the suction is too strong, it might impair the healing of the actual defect in the pleura.
So that's why sometimes we'll go up to minus 30, minus 40, we'll see the bubbling continue, but really no improvement in the lung not coming up. We'll say, okay, that didn't work. Let's go down on the suction now. And so we'll start working our way down from minus 30 to minus 20, minus 10, maybe minus 5. And again, try to get to a point where we're able to remove enough air from the chest without the patient becoming symptomatic, but also allowing that hole to kind of slowly seal itself off as we decrease the gradient for air to move across that pleural defect. And that's where there's a lot of talking to the patient, just saying, hey, we're just doing a little bit of trial and error to see if we can balance getting the air out of your chest with getting this hole to heal.
So that anticipatory guidance that we're trying to find that fine balance between getting as much air out, but also allowing the hole to heal.
And so that's what we're looking for every day. And what we're trying to do is get that air leak to slowly resolve, to get the patient on less and less suction, and then get them off to water seal. The benefit of getting a patient off of suction onto water seal, and that means that they're, when we say the patient's on water seal, it just means that they're not on suction anymore. They don't need to be on suction. And the benefit of that is that that usually means that the air leak gets improved to a certain point that the patient's able to tolerate just being on water seal, meaning that if you take them off, it's being generated in the chest that their water seal can't keep up with it, that you actually need to exert more suction. And the benefit of that, as I was saying, was really to allow patients to be free of the wall, right? Because when they're on suction, they're just literally tethered to the wall, or they need some sort of portable suction device.
And just to say it loud, if interventional palm says, you know, let's put the patient off suction, that means by default, the patient is going to be then put on water seal. And here with water seal, it's gravity alone is enough to help the pneumothorax resolve. Again, been such a high yield teaching on the different sections of the drainage system. And every time we go through, I'm like, oh, another point clicks. Alexander, why don't you summarize?
Sure. So after the collection chamber, which is less important for a pneumothorax, the next chamber will be the water seal. Remember, the intrapleural pressure is negative and air flows from high to low. So the water seal chamber ensures air only flows out of the pleural space and prevents the pneumothorax from expanding. On top of that, it allows for visualization of an air leak, which is diagnostically useful for pneumothorax.
The last one is a suction chamber, which is usually on the left-hand side. And depending on the system, you're using, it might be a circle knob. So suction is added to help draw out more air from the chest. And this chamber looks like a dial to show what degree of suction is being applied. And it also is needed because once a specific pressure is set, the valve pops off and closed to ensure that the amount of pressure is stable to prevent patient injury. I am so excited to have Echo Core 500 Digital Stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his, and I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x, and then on top of that, it has noise cancellation so you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team, or on a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy. It's backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for the devices and the AI algorithms. So those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently, and if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to ecohealth.com/quorium for $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's ekohealth.com/quorium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Here at Quorium, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today we're talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-up room looking way more put together after a night shift. And I knew right then and there, they were wearing FIGS. FIG Scrubs is made specifically for us doctors, residents, students, healthcare professionals who are putting in long hours and really need gear that can keep up and perform on our level. We have so much going on in any shift, right? Scrubs are the last thing we want to be thinking about, and that's why FIGS is great in that they're lightweight, stretchy, breathable. They have all the small touches that have made me a true convert. They're clean, they're modern, super functional, tons of pockets that I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve FIGS. So head over to FIGS.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's FIGS.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first purchase. And with that, let's head back to the episode. So now that we're oriented to the three different parts of the Dream System, let's get to what we really are going to be looking at every day in a patient with a pneumothorax, which is that second chamber, the water seal part. Now, we've already mentioned the water seal is where we're going to check to see if there's bubbling and if there's an air leak. But I think there's so many questions here, right? Like, is all air bubbles mean air leak?
All good questions. But first things first, in or near that water seal chamber, there's usually a small white ball. And if you see that ball moving up and down with respiration, this is called tidaling. And that's to be expected with normal breathing.
And what you want to see that is with the respiratory cycle, you want to see that fluid kind of moving in and out a little bit. And sometimes it's a subtle movement. Sometimes it's a very exaggerated movement. But you do want to see some motion as the patient breathes in and out, right? Because as the patient breathes in, pleural pressure gets a little negative, the fluid moves towards the chest. As the patient breathes out, pleural pressure gets a little positive, fluid moves away towards the pleural back. And you want to see that. If you're not seeing that, then that might be another indication that the chest tube is kinked, or for some reason, someone clamped it and didn't realize that they did.
So tidaling is just a visual demonstration of pressure changes with normal breathing, typically of fluid in the chest tube itself. And so water in that water seal with a little white ball should rise towards the chest with inhalation and fall away from the chest with exhalation. That's indicating that the chest tube is working properly.
So this movement of fluid up and down is different from bubbling, which represents an air leak. And that means there's still a pneumothorax, but there's a surprising amount of depth to how we can exactly measure and quantify the air leak to get a sense of what's going on in the pleural space.
One thing that I like to explain to teams, as well as patients too, is sort of how we measure the air leak, right? How do we know that there's still air coming out of the chest, meaning that pleural defect, that hole in the pleural surface is still there? And so that's where we're looking for bubbling in the water seal. And the way that we try to come to sort of quantify that is something called our Serfolio classification for air leaks, which is a really simple classification system. It's really easy, really reproducible. And so it's sort of become the standard for monitoring or measuring air leaks. And so the worst is a grade 4 or a continuous air leak. And so that's, you know, regardless of if the patient's breathing in, breathing out, holding their breath, you just see a constant stream of bubbles in the water seal. That's a continuous or a grade 4 air leak.
And now you can always look up the Serfolio classification to quantify air leaks, and grade 4 being the worst compared to grade 1 or having no air leak. You don't have to memorize these, but I did find it helpful, at least for me, to hear the differences and understand the IP speak a little bit more.
A grade 2 air leak is an intermediate. It's called an intermittent expiratory air leak. And so this is where you don't see continuous air leak anymore. The leak's gotten a little bit better. So the patient breathes in, intrathoracic pressure drops a little bit, so you see the air leak resolve. You don't see bubbles. Patient breathes out or exhales, and you see a couple of bubbles as intrathoracic pressure goes up a little bit. So you sit there and watch the patient just kind of breathe comfortably for a couple of respiratory cycles, and you'll see no bubbles inspiration, bubbles expirate. That's a grade 2. The grade 1 is the smallest air leak, and so that's called a forced expiratory air leak. So when you come into the room, just talk to the patient or breathing comfortably, tidally, you'll look at the pleural back and you won't see any bubbles at all, but you'll ask the patient to do a forced expiratory maneuver. So take a deep breath in and blow out as far as you can, cough, or maybe bear down and do a Valsalva, and that'll spike intrathoracic pressure and you'll see a couple of bubbles come out. And so that's what I explain to the patients when I'm examining them, just say, I'm just trying to measure how bad the leak is in terms of how much pressure is required for you to generate to get some bubbling to create this air leak. So what we like to see every day is from the patient to go from a continuous to an intermittent expiratory air leak to a grade 1 or a forced. that means the beer league is improving.
Yeah, I feel like before I heard this, I would just like kind of squint at the water seal part and see like how much bubbling I was seeing. Is it less bubbling than what I remember yesterday? But it sounds like I should be really looking at that bubbling and how it compares to the respiratory cycle. I'm curious, Alexander, is this something like you've actually done? And I don't know, like I can imagine some patients, like, is that inhalation? Is that exhalation?
Yeah, I've definitely seen pulmonologists ask patients to do all of these maneuvers, deep breathing, bearing down, or even just normal talking, and then staring at the drainage system throughout to try to track these changes with where they're occurring in the respiratory cycle.
So big picture here is every day we're trying to move the needle forward for our patient, helping them go from suction to being off suction, aka being on water seal, and then from there, hopefully having no air leak enough to do something called a clamp trial. This is our last step before removal of that chest tube. And it's basically a test run for the patient to see how they would do without that chest tube, without actually taking the chest tube out.
And the important thing about a clamp tube is it's basically not having a chest tube at all, right? And so you really want to be mindful of monitoring that patient and communicating with everybody about what you've done, including the patient. And so when I'm clamping a chest tube, I will show them. I'll say, hey, this is me clamping your chest tube. If you start having chest pain, if you start having shortness of breath, if you don't feel good, call for help and unclamp your chest tube. And this is how you unclamp it. And so most patients, they're able to be empowered to do that on their own.
And so the biggest takeaway about a clamp trial is that patients should be able to look out for any symptoms like shortness of breath or chest pain that might indicate they're not quite ready for the tube to come out yet. And they should feel empowered if they're able to even reclamp the tube themselves if these symptoms come up.
All right, this has been a lot of great information. And so why don't we summarize what we've learned so far?
So the water seal chamber is where you can visualize tidaling as well as an air leak. Up and down movement of fluid within the tube or of the indicator ball with respiration indicates normal chest tube function. But loss of this tidaling with the indicator ball can indicate kinking in the chest tube or displacement of the tube.
Right. And then if you see any bubbling, that means that there is an air leak, aka the pneumothorax is still present. And I think I've learned that if I ask a patient to take a slow breath in and out, I can better characterize the degree of bubbling and how bad that air leak is. So now we discussed the back and forth between suction and water seal that can happen. But say this air leak is just not going away. Every day we're going in, we're still seeing that bubbling in that water seal chamber. What do we do?
Usually we will start doing these maneuvers over like the first 4 or 5 days, because once we hit day 5, that's where we start hitting the definition of what we call a persistent air leak. And that's just some sort of arbitrary time point, day 5, where we call it a persistent air leak. And we say, okay, now we need to start doing some of the other things to try to get this moving along so we can get this patient home.
So 5 days is typically the mark to think about. And at that point, there are 3 major options: blood patches, endobronchial valves, and pleurodesis.
One of the things that we commonly think employ is something called a blood patch, and that's an autologous blood patch. And so we're using the patient's own blood in that scenario. Not a lot of evidence to support its use, but the case series that have been reported so far have shown some success. And so it is relatively commonly used just because of how easy and safe it is to do. So what we do is we literally take 100 to 120 cc's of the patient's own blood and then insert it via the chest tube into the pleural space, with the goal being that blood will hopefully find its way to this pleural defect and create a clot over it that will then sort of like patching a tire. There's also some pleurodesis that happens because blood is a partial pleurodesing agent. And so you will get some pleurodesis as well too to get the lung to stick up to the chest wall. The biggest risk to a blood patch is infection, and because it's basically like adding culture media to wherever you're putting it.
So basically, a blood patch is using a little bit of that patient's blood, about like a third of a soda can, you know, 120 cc's. And then interventional pulmonologists are putting that blood through the chest tube to help patch up the hole in the lung. Hence, it's called a blood patch.
This can be done several times. So sometimes, if you look in the literature, it would suggest upwards of a 70-80% success rate with initial blood patches. Clinically speaking, I haven't found it to be that high on initial trial, but sometimes on a second try, we've gotten a lot more success, or sometimes even a third. So blood patch is a good option. One thing to think about with that is that if a patient's on anticoagulation, so if they're on like a apixaban or if they're on a heparin infusion, that's going to make your blood patch less effective than if they're not on anticoagulation.
And hopefully anticoagulation can be held long enough so that the blood patch can do its thing. But yeah, this seems like a real advantage in trying something that's not invasive and less permanent than some of the other options.
The other options are endobronchial valves, which is something that's really come a long way in the last 5 to 10 years as a wonderful tool for patients with persistent air leaks. And so these are one-way valves, so they're placed bronchoscopically. And so they allow, in whatever segment you place them, they allow air to move proximally. So for, air to come from the lungs to the central airways and breathed out, but they don't let any further air go out into that segment.
So an endobronchial valve is another great tool, but again, it does require an invasive bronch and risks come with that, of course, with sedation and all.
Lastly, pleuritesis is an option for both persistent air leak as well as for prevention of pneumothorax recurrence.
So if a patient's air leak is persistent but low, so that they can have some time off suction, again, you can give 4 grams of sterile talc into the pleural space. Caveat to know about talc pleuritesis is it can be painful. So typically we will have access to pain medications for the patients. And we also instill 300 milligrams of lidocaine into the pleural space before administering the talc to help make it less painful.
So to summarize, air leaks are defined as persistent after 5 days, and there's a variety of different ways we can deal with it. One is a blood patch where we're literally using the patient's blood to help patch up the hole in the pleura. Second is an endobronchial valve placement, which requires an invasive bronch procedure. And then lastly, pleuritesis, where the talc can be quite painful, and each come with its different risks and may be suited for different patients.
So that wraps up our episode on pneumothorax.
And if you got any value from this podcast, our ask is to please share this with at least one other colleague that could also use a nice aha moment. I know I certainly had tons of actually like eureka moments from this. Thank you to our peer reviewers, Dr. Laura Frey and Dr. Danielle Dunlap. And as always, we love hearing feedback. So please email us at hello@coreampodcast.com. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you. Take care.